Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I'm here with Patrice Saigei. Patrice is an internationally recognized author, business trainer, speaker, and business coach with a unique ability to combine entrepreneurship principles with biblical wisdom. He is the chief servant officer of Nehemiah Project International's ministries. And for the past 20 years, he has trained and coached over 5,000 entrepreneurs and business owners around the world. He is a man with a gift of insight, as I know personally, and he has a deep love for people. Patrice is a dear friend of myself and my family, and was very much looking forward to this interview. I know you, but the opportunity to share your stories with others, I think, will be great for everybody to hear. So welcome, Patrice.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Jeff, by the way, a little correction. I have done over 5,000 entrepreneurs. As an organization, we've trained over 20,000 entrepreneurs.
Wow.
In the last 21 years.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing. Where are you located right now, just so we get a sense? I'm in Orlando. You are?
I'm in Vancouver, Washington.
The wonderful Pacific Northwest.
That's right. You know something about it.
I do know something.
It's God's country. I don't care what they say.
It is clearly God's country certain times of the year.
Well said.
Your story, your upbringing is by far going to be the most, one of the most unique people I've had so far on this podcast. So I'm going to give you a little more time on this than normal, but where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? And then just a high level of your career.
Yes. So I grew up, I was born in Cameroon, Central Africa, French speaking. The country is bilingual, French and English, but predominantly French. I grew up in a typical, I guess, family, prestigious, I guess you would call it, affluent African family, business and politics. My grandfather was a king. My mother was an entrepreneur and politician. So grew up around, I guess, what we call affluence, but was sent to the United States at 11 years old for education as well. My grandmother was concerned that I would not become a responsible man around my family. So I needed to get as far away as possible.
Patrice, hold on. You just said a word I want to make sure everybody heard, because I remember the first time you and I were chatting, it just kind of rolled off your tongue, and I'm sitting there going, did I hear what he said? Did you say the word king?
Yes.
All right, stop there for a second and give us a little snippet of what you mean by a king.
Well, my great-great-grandfather was what you call a first-degree king. He led over a village of about 50,000+ people. Huh. So that would be the royal family that I'm a part of. And then my grandfather, who was a prince of that royal family, was given his own territory. So he would be a third-degree king. But because of his military acumen and his business skills, his fame and his kingdom overshadowed his grandfather's. Mm. Because literally, when you go to that area of the country, they know more my grandfather than know his grandfather. Mm-hmm. He was just such, he almost bought a plane. He was a translator for the German and the French. So he was a very well-known, one of the wealthiest guy of men of Western Cameroon or Southern Cameroon during that time of his time. He had about 90 wives, about 250 children. So this was, those of you who know the Bible, the real King Solomon was his day.
All right. So, I mean, we could talk for hours on that, because I think that's going to blow people's mind, let alone what you just said. But so you come to the U.S. Go, keep going.
So I came to the U.S. Those who are from Washington, D.C. will know a school called West Washington International School. It's a prestigious elite high school for elites of you know, diplomats and U.S. elites, right there on Connecticut Avenue. So I was able to go to school like normal, in French while learning English at the same time. And so that was kind of my education. So fast forward, a couple of years later, my mother did a business deal with an American businessman who, part of the deal was that he would pay for my education. Like any other shrewd businessman, he took me out of the $12,000 a year high school and put me in a $4,000 a year private school. Who wouldn't do that, right?
Right.
So I got a chance to get a traditional American education, because in that private school was, you know, typical middle class Americans. And I think that was very good for me. That's when I really got immersed into the American culture. But I was not a very good student, Jeff. I was a D average student.
Really?
And then when I came out of high school, barely, I dropped out of college my first year, my first semester, in part because my family went through civil unrest in my country. That was due to political unrest. And so that really is when the defining moment of my life. I'm 18 years old, and my world gets turned upside down, and the source of my survival is shut down completely.
Interesting. What happens from there?
Well, so I was like any other kid. I was trying to figure out how to set a path for a future that I had not planned for. I was undisciplined academically. I was unprepared. And also I was very traumatically disturbed, because obviously the world that you've known has just turned upside down. But a few months later, I said to myself, you know, if you could do anything that you want to do and you were sure that failure was not an option, what would it be? And for me, it was business. I grew up in a business family. That's all I've known. I had two objectives growing up: law and business. Since I had screwed up academically, law was not an option. So I figured, what's the one thing you could do, you know, having screwed academically? Business was the case. So I went into business. So I convinced my mother that she would allow me to open an office here in the U.S. of her company, to kind of try to revive the family. Remember, I'm 18, 19 years old at this point. So she agrees. 6 months into it, I realized something, Jeff, that I'm third in line. And the reality of leading the family business in America, my siblings kept interfering.
From Cameroon.
From Cameroon. And some of them had come here because when the civil unrest occurred, different ones went in different places around the world. And some came here to the United States. So at this point, I realized something. Though this was my initiative, though this was my idea, but I had no control. The decision was being made from a bunker in Cameroon. And I needed to do something that I had complete control over. And of course, having had the rug pulled from under me once, I did not want that to happen again. So I broke away from the family business to do something that I would have complete control of my own destiny. And that was to be a consultant and a business educator.
How much did that disrupt the family?
Well, the family didn't think I was going to make it, so they didn't see it as a loss.
I appreciate your honesty.
So for them, they saw it as a foolish, stubborn young kid not getting his way.
Okay.
Because, I mean, obviously, my reputation up to that point, they had no basis to think otherwise, to be honest. But what they didn't realize was that I had a conviction. You're an entrepreneur. You know something about conviction.
Yep.
I had a conviction, and I had a dream. I wanted to become financially independent. And so that had a lot of power, and they didn't realize that power.
So what would have been, could you have articulated your dream at that point besides being financially independent?
No. I know I wanted to impact the world. I know I wanted to be a positive influence. But at that very moment, that was almost secondary. Primarily at that moment for me was wanting to be financially independent.
Okay. So now take us real quickly from that point to what you're doing today, just high level. I'm assuming you'll fill in some of that as we continue the dialogue.
So remember, I'm a college dropout. I've left the family business. So really, that's all I knew. So now I got to chart a path that lands me somewhere where I can rebuild a foundation that I don't have to run the family. That was scary. But you know, Jeff, having grown up with my mother and having translated for her and being part of all the meetings and seeing her negotiate, I had a weird sense of confidence that I knew more than the average person. Mm-hmm. And because I would be in these business meetings and I would kind of, you know, how if you're watching your parents or you play chess and you're kind of second guessing them. And,
yep.
You know, so I had all these things in my head that I now get a chance to practice it without, to execute it without anybody holding me back. So that excited me. So fast forward, I began to be recognized as a leader in Washington, D.C., that was leading other young people. Because as I was doing that, a lot of my friends began to admire my drive. And they also wanted to be entrepreneurs. So I started an entrepreneurship club. And so I became an educator and a speaker for others wanting to be in business for themselves. Now, I wasn't making any money this time, but I was an inspiration for many. So fast forward, I then began to consult and start a nonprofit organization and began to speak and really discovered that I had this passion about helping people understand the power of economics and the fact you have options and the power of entrepreneurship. And that became kind of my drive.
Well, and now everybody can see why you're on this podcast with me, because you understand the power of capital, which we're going to get into in a little bit. Give us just a snippet of, so everybody can understand, Nehemiah Project. What do you guys do? Then I want to get to understand where you are at today and how you describe where you at are on this broader journey. So at least give us a little bit first about Nehemiah Project, just so we get a sense of what you do on a day-to-day basis.
You know, Steve Jobs made a statement that do what you love, right? And we all know that Steve Jobs, whether you like him or not, he's been known for passionately pursuing an idea called Apple. And through that, the world is a better place and our economy is better for it. For me, that was impacting people through entrepreneurship. That was what I loved, this combination of business and people. Remember, earlier I said I had this thing that I wanted to impact people and had this passion for business. The two kind of came together by the direction of my attorney. And so I became an advocate, especially for the underprivileged, help them understand the power of entrepreneurship and capital. So, but then something else happened, Jeff, is that I became a Christian.
Okay.
And that also brought a different dimension, because what I recognize is that in my journey to use entrepreneurship and economics education as a tool to help the underserved find a way into mainstream economy, i.e. drug dealers, young people who were African Americans, particularly at that time, who were underserved, I then realized that becoming a Christian, I discovered that the Bible now gave me a tool to deal with a soul. In other words, I was a capitalist. I am a capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
But I discovered that there was this, because I always had this sense of that capitalism is a redeeming tool.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, I never had a way to anchor it on something that was transformative. And that's what my personal Christian faith brought to the table. So I was not able to mix the two. And by the way, up to that point, I didn't have a curriculum. I didn't have intellectual property. I have ideas, and I was inspirational. So I brought the two together, and from there created a program called Biblical Entrepreneurship. So I began to be known to teach people using my own unique systems on how to do business using transformational principles from the Bible. And that's essentially what brought about the birth of the Nehemiah Project. We've done 20,000 entrepreneurs year to date. And what I also discovered is that as good as my family was, and as generous as they were, you know, we operate in the gray. My mother, the end justified the means. And there were a lot of tactics that mother employed that for good reasons. She didn't play in the middle of the field, you know? And so as a young man, evolving, trying to be different. This was also the time where social entrepreneurship was rising, and that really attracted me. So I became a social entrepreneur and evolved into what today I would call a kingdom business person, somebody who recognized that business is the power of good, capital is essential for human survival, but a redemptive approach must be grounded on principles that are unchanging and long-lasting.
So I'm assuming that we have a number of listeners who may not share your faith, may not really know, I mean, clearly know the Bible is, but may not, I mean, biblical entrepreneurship. Give us just a little snippet of what does biblical entrepreneurship mean? I mean, how do you use the Bible to teach entrepreneurship?
Well, I wasn't the first one to do it. Harvard University, first business curriculum is actually the Bible, if you go back to its history. America, business principles, if you go back to our early history, the Quakers, and there's a lot of tradition that came from the Bible that has influenced our business world. The idea is this, is that business is a tool for good, but then what is the basis or the standard upon which good can be defined, or a framework that can allow all of us to identify what good is? And the Bible becomes that base. An example, something like going the extra mile. That's a very biblical scripture. How do you apply that to business? Love your neighbor as yourself, right? How do you apply that? So just kind of taking something as the Ten Commandments, you know, you do not cover your neighbor's stuff, right? Do not steal, right? You know, how do you take these historical, well-known principles that we take for granted, and how do you apply it in the era of commerce? That's what biblical entrepreneurship does. It's an intentional approach to using scripture. And by the way, this is good for Christians and non-Christians. I'm assuming if you're Muslim, you use the Quran. If you're a Buddhist, you use whatever they use. But the idea is that having a guideline that we can all agree as a basis for good.
So let me go to the question that I had kind of paraphrased before. So you're, what, 30 years into your career, whatever the exact math is, you've been successful, you've helped entrepreneurs all across the world. How would you describe who Patrice is today in light of this journey that you're on, whatever that journey is?
So I began my journey looking for financial security. I evolved into really finding and discovering purpose. So the Patrice today is one who financial security has become less and less a priority to my own, sometimes my wife wishes it hadn't been. But what has I've discovered along the way is this idea of impact, transformation, the idea of privilege and how to use it for the greater good. And so that's what I've evolved into. And I discovered, Jeff, in that process, I have found financial security.
Boy, I could go down 12 different paths here, but I'm going to try to stick to my normal path. Otherwise, we'll take forever. So you may have already answered this question, but in light of what you're doing, and actually, I interview a lot of people, and I use the word, how are you trying to change the world, probably metaphorically, but in your case, you actually are trying to impact and change the world. So how would you describe how you're trying to change the world?
Well, let me give context as I answer that. So I grew up in Africa, a country that was dominated by colonialism, those who know the history of Africa, and came to America, experienced the history of African Americans and the evolution of the American experiment, and saw this sense of social and political injustices. For me, I saw business and economics, capital, as the key instrument that could be the game changer in all of that. So for me, I grew up privileged because my family had economic wherewithal, right? And I recognized that. And so then I said, okay, if others are able to have economic or the opportunity for economics wherewithal, it then will address all the other issues. Because at the end of the day, I'm convinced, Jeff, that it's more about economics than it is about all the other issues. Yeah. So for me, I want to change the world by giving the average individual who may not come from privilege, may not have the pedigree that I have, may not even have the education, oh, I don't have the education, but may not have the, you know, how do, by attending my seminar, being coached by them, by being part of our community, you know, can I give them a lift that they can experience economic freedom? And in that process, discover, like I did, that is more than just about economics. Mm-hmm. Really, it's about the freedom to do what you really want to do, which hopefully it'll be impact the world.
It actually just makes me think of what's going on in our world today. And I couldn't agree more that a lot of this is about money and power. But what's interesting is your statement is, from your own experience, you'd say that money and power don't ultimately solve what you're trying to solve. It's something more than that.
My family has experienced a lot of money and power. We are the top 1% of our country. My grandfather was the top man. And actually, to be honest, I can see a lot of dysfunction in my family that came as a result of money and power. And that's in part what I discovered in my own journey. Breaking away from my family was the best thing that could happen to me, because what it did, it helped me to isolate myself from the dysfunction so I can discover me and in turn be able to find a way to contribute in a healthier manner. A lot of very wealthy families are hurting.
Yeah.
And so we have to acknowledge that. It becomes a prison. It's difficult. And my own siblings began their own journey after my mother died. And for a long time, they would say, Patrice, how do we find the freedom you've discovered? I say, turn your back from the money. How do you turn your back from financial certainty without any effort?
This reminds me, and I got to be careful how I say this, because I think there's a lot of wonderful things about America. And I think that depending on how you define the American dream, I think there's a lot of wonderful aspirations there. But I also think that there's kind of this lie that a lot of us have bought into, and it's what you and I just were discussing, that if you have the big house and you have the financial security, that all of a sudden you've got joy and happiness and freedom. And that's just not true. I mean, I've got a lot of, because of my past experience, I've run into a lot of wealthy individuals. And I know people will laugh when I say this, but a lot of them, I wouldn't want their life. The money complicates stuff.
Well said.
Yeah.
And that's a lesson that's hard to grab if you've not experienced money. Right. Yeah. Because it sounds like you're almost saying because you've had it or you have it, you know, but it's true. Mm-hmm. It's true. Your life becomes more complicated the more you earn. Now, but if you discover a sense of purpose,
right,
a sense, again, let's go back to Steve Jobs. I mean, he wasn't a perfect man. But what I love about Steve Jobs is that it wasn't about the money for him. It was about fulfilling this sense of purpose and passion, and the money followed. Mm-hmm. And when you look at him against his competitor, for those that it was about the money, they didn't remain pure to what it is they were after. The money will follow if you make it about the right thing, and mm-hmm. you will not be imprisoned by it.
You know, I want to go back real fast. Something that you said earlier is still kind of resonating in my brain. And that was that you grew up in a royal family. Is that fair to say? Yes. Is that how you guys talk about it? And yet you didn't have a ton of mentorship when you got here to the U.S. and, you know, you didn't do well in school, but you still, and it doesn't, I mean, maybe I'm wrong here. It didn't sound like your parents, did they give you a bunch of money when you came here? Or do you have, they did. Okay. Well, but it's still where I was going with this is you said something that I think is really powerful that we often dismiss. And I'll just use me as an example as well. I grew up, my dad's a physician. I didn't go to medical school. It's amazing today how many dialogues I can be in with people and be able to hang in the medical field because I grew up around it. Just like you grew up and around an entrepreneur. And there's a mindset that you got to experience firsthand that has, in this example, let's just say money, you can leave the money out. but it gave you skills and something to draw upon that you look at a lot of families today, the family unit's broken, whatever, and they don't have the ability to be mentored and to see how to run businesses like you saw with your mom.
Well said. I mean, ultimately, so even though my mom gave it, but it came now there was a guardianship. My aunt and uncle were my guardians. So I didn't, they were managing all of that. But here's the thing. So when everything got pulled away, so I became a young adult. At that point, I started managing my money, right? But when everything got pulled away is when I discovered that the true gift that I had wasn't the money my parents were giving, but it was the thing that I had learned from them that I experienced with them. That became the gift that ended up defining my career. The fact that I realized that, wait a minute, I've been privileged. I've been exposed to things and learned things that most of my peers have no clue. Yep. So I then began to act upon that. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the knowledge and the exposure, I guess that in a sense, it's privilege. The privilege, like you.
Yep.
The privilege wasn't the money your family had, but the exposure and the things you learned that gave you a competitive advantage over most of your peers who may even had money, but had not been exposed to what you've been exposed to.
Yeah, so it's just a reminder to me that clearly you got to have money. But money doesn't fix everything anyways.
You got it.
And so even, I don't care how much money you have, you always think you could use more. And there's just, I guess it's just a great reminder that there's more than money. So while we're talking about money and while we're talking about the power of capital, do you remember when you recognized this power of capital?
When my family went through civil unrest and the money stopped coming into my bank account. And all of a sudden, I had to survive on what I earned. So up until that point, I had a high school job that I had gotten one in high school just for play. Because my aunt said, you don't need a job. You know, people like you don't work. Well, I thought a job was fun. So that's why I got a job. All of a sudden, my freshman year in college, everything changes. And now I have to budget for the first time in my entire life. Guess what I discovered?
What's that?
I had not enough money. All of a sudden, everything kind of comes home for me. And at that moment, I had to reorder my life to acquire capital so that I can survive. It was a tough lesson. It was a tough lesson, but a necessary lesson. I literally remember the image in my head. I said, okay, I need to downsize my life to my income. Mm-hmm. Now, it's easier said than done because I had habits
mm-hmm.
and a lifestyle
mm-hmm.
that felt like I was killing myself. But I knew I had to go through it because I could blame nobody but myself. Because every time I had money prior, I was the party guy. I was the one with the car, with the one with the penthouse. I was the one who took my friend shopping. Right. So I couldn't blame anybody. So all of a sudden, I realized that my lifestyle had to adjust to what I could earn. And that's the minute I realized the power of capital.
It makes sense. I'm curious. We won't go down this path, but I bet that's impacted the way you have raised and trained your daughters.
100%. 100%. Yeah. So unlike me, my youngest is 16 years old. Guess what? She got a car. She's paying for it. Right? Unlike me, my children, once they could work became a necessity as a way to provide for themselves beyond what I could do. While for me, work was people like you don't work. Right? It was for play. No, they work not for play because it ties directly into their ability to provide for themselves things that I'm choosing not to do because I was provided for beyond what I could work and I never saw the connection until the crisis occurred.
Yeah.
So if something happens to me today, my children, they're going to be fine. They can earn their way into sustainability. They don't have to go through the years of pain that I had to go through.
You obviously acquire knowledge, you start a business, assuming you've got enough capital to live. Either how did you or how do you think about stewardship today? Because obviously you've got a greater purpose than just capital today. So how do you describe, what do you think of stewardship and how do you live by it?
Well, I think stewardship is about efficiently managing the capital, both fixed assets and liquid, and opportunities that you've been given. Because it's really about, okay, how do I, as Patrice Sagay and my wife, how do we manage both the fixed and liquid assets as well as opportunities? Because, you know, in business, you hear about opportunity costs, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we have influence, and by the way, it also includes, when I say fixed and liquid asset, it also includes intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So an example, you know, my book just came out. My entire career has been built around my ability to communicate ideas that help entrepreneurs and inspire them to be able to be successful or find fulfillment, right? So for me, a part of stewardship is how do I productize my intellectual property? How do I steward it in a way that, or manage it in a way that generations after me can reference it and build upon it? You know, so one aspect of it is about economics, but the other aspect of it is about legacy. It's about contribution. You know, I'm inspired by the writings of those who came before me. I'm inspired by all of these archives of history. Well, how do I contribute to those archives of history? That's part of stewardship, so that the next Patrice Sagay doesn't have to rethink biblical entrepreneurship, but rather they can build and reference what I've done and maybe take it to another level, right? Look at how technology has advanced. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same with knowledge have advanced. Generations after generation built upon the ideas of those who came before them. So for me, stewardship is really about that, so that when I'm gone, others, because I was a good steward, are able to build upon both the hard assets, the liquids, the ideas, the influence that I've been able to contribute towards. And that includes also my children's legacy as well.
Big, big question. But if you could have one dream come true or a couple dreams, what would they be?
Well, for me, it would be that I have the financial freedom to be able to avail myself to being a coach and a mentor for African business and political leaders, mm-hmm, to help shape the next generation. There's a guy named Bill Campbell, mm-hmm, that there's a book that's written, The Trillion-Dollar Coach, that he's helped to influence over $1 trillion of value in our economy because of what he did for the dot-com millionaires, that, you know, these Silicon Valley billionaires. Well, and he did that for free. He made himself available as a coach to these leaders, Bill Gates and the like. One of the sad things about Africa, and I guess because I'm from Africa, is that there's a lack of effective leadership, period. Hmm. And part of that is because you don't have people who are not agenda driven and are respected, who you don't have statements. I mean, this is sounds very, but you don't, not enough of them. You don't have the Mandelas. You don't have men and women who, whether in the business world, the political, who don't have a dog in the fight, that are willing to, that's what made America great. Men and women who are willing to use their privilege, use their influence, use their wealth, philanthropists, to shape, to create an institution, to direct the nation. That's my heart, because I saw my mother sacrifice for Cameroon and for Africa. And I really admired her for the fact that it was never about the money for her. It was about the legacy of, it was about her father's legacy, which is my grandfather. It was about her country. She was a patriot. It was about being the first woman to break these barriers. It was about living up Africa's greatness, right? So if I had my one wish, is get to a place where I no longer have to be incentivized by the contracts mm-hmm. and the, though I'm not saying I'm saying no to them, mm-hmm. but I can prioritize how I spend my life by investing in leaders who can change that continent. Because I think, Jeff, I think it's possible. Mm-hmm. I really do. If America can work, Africa can work. But it takes sacrificial leaders who have the resources to deploy and the influence to command respect.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I hadn't heard that from you before. Now, obviously, you have a deep passion for entrepreneurs and leadership all around the world. And you're from Africa, but I didn't know it was that specific what you're talking about. I lied. I got to have one more question now. Why do you think the leadership within Africa, which obviously is a huge statement because there's, 52 different countries or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Why is leadership lacking?
They've not seen images. They're not enough national and regional pictures of leaders that have lived to tell the story that others can be inspired by that look like them. If you notice, a lot of African, when they talk about their leaders that they look up to, they're all dead, most of them. Mm. Right? I mean, most of them. Mm-hmm. Most of the ones that, unless they're very marginal. So you don't have enough. What creates a culture is that you have living, you have both legacy and living beings who are modeling it, who live to tell the story. So as a result, who wants to be a leader in an environment where the good ones die?
Right.
And so as a result, we don't think it's possible. There's this mental picture in our head. And then the other piece is there's a lot of suspicion that, you know, here you guys call it here conspiracy mm-hmm. theory, you mm-hmm. know, a lot of suspicion that govern the continent, you know. So an environment we don't see images of greatness and effective use of capital and effective use of power. And if you have that plus suspicion, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it makes me think of the U.S. right now. And, you know, we won't go down the whole political route, but it just keeps coming into my head of, one, how important leadership is. And we've probably seen a lack of it to me on both sides. But I think the other thing that you just said that intuitively, I think we know it, but I think the further we get away from the early periods of American history, we lose it. And we forget that those leaders paid a price.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's one of the things that I would argue we've probably forgotten is that freedom. it came through cost and sacrifice and death.
Nothing inspires me, Jeff, more than the American story. Because real life modern people who paid a price. If you look at history, many who paid a price was always for self-glory. The difference with these, right? These were, when you look at the French Revolution or you look at, you know, the Protestant movement, whatever, there have been movements that have done similar, but nothing that have transformed itself into a government that aspires to keep that up. That's America. Mm-hmm. That aspired in business, in that has been so multifaceted. And you have to give credit to England, because if you look at the history of England, it kind of nurtured that idea, right? As a government, you know. So, and I guess I'm envious, Jeff. But here's the thing. I know it can happen in Africa, but the problem is the narrative doesn't give Africans the freedom to embrace it. And then here's also, part of it is this too, for me, Jeff, is that, because if you got to make one contribution, where would it be? So it's not just because I'm African, and in part it is, but because that's the place that I believe I can move the dial the furthest,
right?
Giving my disposition, right? Because I could have picked, you know, the United States of America. But I think that there's a lot of options for the United States. As bad as we think America is, trust me.
Right.
You know, I could have picked, you know, Latin America, but I don't speak Spanish. I could have picked Asia. I don't speak Mandarin Chinese, though we have offices there. But when I look, okay, Patrice, if you and your wife, where would it be? Because I'm African. I'm a product of Africa privilege. I understand the dynamics of abuse of power. I understand, I own the fact that part of my, I benefited from the corruption of Africa. Mm-hmm. I own that. Who best then to address it than those who have, and I can inspire others like myself. The children of the top 10%, because we are the ones to pay the price.
Did we just get a snapshot of the next chapter in your life?
God willing, brother. But that's why that requires true financial freedom, because you can't go in it having, when I look at, you know, others who've done it, you can't go into it. Give it somebody in the business world. Look at what Elon Musk is doing right now. Uh-huh. Right? It wasn't about the money for him. But look at what's happening with electric cars and mm-hmm. in the space. Where is that for Africa in terms of the culture, societies? Where are the Mandelas? Look at what Mandela did. One person. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, after him, what's next? What's behind him? Mm-hmm. But there are many, Jeff, who unfortunately haven't had the courage or the wherewithal to fully rise.
All right. Well, I know what I'm going to cheer for. I think you can do it. Where do you want to be? You want to be president of which country over there? Where, strategically, what's the best country to be president of? Don't answer that. Don't answer that. It's too heated.
I don't think government is the answer. I want to be a kingmaker, not a king.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the problem. Right?
No, that's great. Well, Patrice, I could talk for, and we do this normally, talk for another 2 hours. So I appreciate you taking your time, sharing some of your knowledge and willingness to be transparent. You know what? Let's shoot for, I mean, we can do this before this, but let's think out here. Maybe in 15 years, we're going to check back in and see if any of this has come true.
Let's do it, because you know what? In 9 years, I'm moving from Nehemiah Project and maybe starting that next chapter. So 15 years, I should be
perfect
somewhere.
Perfect. And anybody listen who want to help him get financially free so he can go do this, let me know.
I want to lead Nehemiah. I'm also looking for a replacement here.
You can't leave until you get a successor. So
You got it. So, Jeff, if something happens with Common Good and you're looking for something else, give me a call.
I don't know. I've seen you speak, and I don't think I can compete with the way you can get a crowd going and a group of entrepreneurs. So I don't know. Although our head is kind of shaped the same with the same kind of lack of hair.
We both have the Pacific Northwest tradition, you know, so there's some similarities here, my friend.
We do. Well, anyways, thanks so much. And don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new investors find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital. It does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.